Mr. Chalmers, Reel 4. We're talking about your time when you were attached to the 7th Battalion Northern Rhodesian Regiment at Kefu near Lusaka. You weren't there long, I know, but we're sort of looking at some general questions in that period. With the African soldiers, was it a battalion that would have the wives, if they had wives, nearby? Was there a sort of encampment close by?
Not at all. Remember any unit that I was with in East Africa that had that arrangement at all. And in fact, I doubt very much whether they would have. There was no village orientated that the wife would talk to the nearly all the work, I should think, on the farm or back home. And life would have been quite disruptive, I think, if they had joined their husbands there.
Now, how did you go about training your troops? I mean, would you give your orders to your NCOs, or would you talk to them directly in these early stages?
Well, as far as I could, I'd like to do it directly, really. Being a bit schoolmasterly, I suppose.
And what would you train them in? I mean, what was the training program you set about? You mentioned the Bren, I think it was.
Yes. But looking back, school weapon training was very important.
How did they take to weapons training? I mean, was there any? Would it be the same routine as you'd employ with British infantry, or was it slightly different the way you set about training?
It was pretty much the same. I found that we had done battle drill, because they were all Scottish, and I started teaching my platoon that.
Okay, that's a point I should have raised. What about battle drill? What could you just explain roughly what it was and how you bring?
Well, instead of previously there was a tremendous amount of sort of section training going forward and arrowheads and so on, whereas the emphasis on battle drill was merely a kind of reaction to being fired at, I suppose. And I quickly learned the chinyancha for the operative word for down fire, down look, observe fire, anzi kwawa, priya omba. And they took to this. You see, it seemed perfectly reasonable that if you were being fired at, you got down, had a look to see where the fire was coming from, called to a different position so that you wouldn't. And then fire from there. As I say, my colonel, or he was a major, a regular major there, was not aware of the innovation and rather took me to task for not teaching section training as it should be taught, as he thought. However, I think I was able to convince him that this was what was the new thing coming up.
What other training would you give them, your platoon? At that stage?
At that stage.
I mean, would you go on route marches into the countryside?
Yes.
What were they like, the route marches? What was the countryside like? It's so complex.
Northern Rhodesia, where we were, was quite interesting. It had a fair amount of groups and a tremendous number of white outfields, which that was the main feature of the country. But there was quite a lot of roads round about on which you could march with a platoon in formation and singing away and so on.
They used to go on to trips into the bush in peacetime. I mean, you know, long trips for a week or so.
Yes.
Did you do any of that, or was it just a march, as in England, round, you know, 12 miles or whatever?
They were pretty much recruits, and of course, as I wasn't actually terribly long in Northern Indonesia, the battalion was moving up to Kenya, and I actually got malaria before we went. But two or three of us were victims of malaria.
Now, before we go, were there any... What were the health risks that you were warned about, or were you not warned about? Because it's not just malaria, there are other things that can go wrong there.
Yes, malaria was the main menace, and of course we always had to cover up at night. You wear shorts, maybe often during the day, but you had to wear slacks at night, and generally try to...
Would you have a mosquito net?
We have always had mosquito nets at night. Yes.
What about uncovered water and things like that? Would you spray water, or was I think you spray with petrol and things like that? I mean, did you do any of that sort of thing?
Not so much, but we did have. Yes, I think at that stage we had tablets. Water bottles and so on.
Would you have Mepocrine or quinine?
No. Actually, when I got malaria, they treated it with quinine. Mepocrine just came in 1944, I think.
So, later, right.
Yes.
And what was your malaria attack like then when you got it?
I remember feeling that my head was full of molten lead or something like that. I had an old colonial company commander at the time, and he gave me a drink of milk and whiskey in, I think, equal quantities, and I was then taken by a truck to Lusaka to hospital, and then with quinine and so on. It improved pretty quickly. But it was quite shaking. I think I'd had a very high temperature as well, and felt pretty ill. But then was awarded sick leave. I was in hospital for 2 or 3 days, got sick leave, and found that on the railway line you could get to Victoria Falls, which I did, and had a very happy week there.
What was it? I mean, how did it feel going to such amazing places as part of your service for your country, of course? But I mean, it was something you'd read about, Livingston and all the rest of it. But what was it like to actually be at somewhere like that? Because it wasn't a tourist area like it is now.
But it was at that time, it was actually. It was a very well-run hotel. I don't know, I think so many odd things had happened that one just took it in one's stride. You see, I'd been up through Congo, through Tanganyika, across Lake Victoria, seen Ujiji, beneath this tree, H.M. Stanley met Dr. Livingston and so on. I think one just got used to the unexpected.
What happened? That you then rejoined your unit, I presume?
Yes, I went back the same trip through the Congo and up to Nairobi, and found that one company of the unit was actually in Nairobi, but the rest of the battalion was out at Ndurugu, near Sika, guarding Italian prisoners of war.
I suppose you could spell that place, could you?
Ndarugu was Ndarugu. Very small place, it doesn't usually feature on the map.
And that's a.
It was.
Sika.
Sika.
Which is.
Sika, yes.
And. They were guarding Italian POWs. Was it a properly established camp?
Yes.
With wire fences and the rest
of it. Wire fences, yes. With another compound where the fascists were. I think that had been decided by the Italians themselves.
And what was the relationship like with the Italian POWs?
Very agreeable, really. I used to have my hair cut by an Italian barber who tried to teach me a bit of Italian. Like, guerra è dura, mai più dura la prigione. War is hard, but prison is harder. With a broad grin on his face. We were invited to La Fedora Allegra with many women by the prisoners. And when I got there, the man came and said, me interpret, we wait on New York to meet you. And it was a lot of sessions.
So they weren't trying to escape, or? Fairly, I would imagine.
There were at another camp, some had escaped, but the next morning one of them was trying to climb back in as his friend had been eaten by a lion. So, on the whole, there was a competitive problem about that. We had to behave as if. I remember once going around the guards at night and hearing my sentry challenging that it couldn't have been me that he was challenging, and again he challenged a second time and I stopped this guy wondering just why to shoot. Then he'd been bothered by a hyena, and he'd always been told that you must not fire without challenging. So he was challenging the hyena, but the hyena departed. And
what about, and just going on, how did you get on with the officers and NCOs? What was the setup within the, we haven't covered that yet, the battalion? Were the British officers, I presume there'd be no African officers, or were there?
We had no African officers then. Later on, some were made platoon commanders, African platoon commanders, but no, we were white. And
What sort of backgrounds did they have, and how did you get on with them in the mess? Because wouldn't they come? They might well not be young men like yourself, some of them.
No, indeed, one of them, my company commander for a long time, had been in the First War, and in fact had been a regular subaltern before the First War. Since then, been working with the British Rails, I think. But, well, he was fascinating. I discovered from him, for instance, that in his regiment, not sure which it was, a subaltern of appointment was not spoken to for 6 months. And that had completely gone with it.
So he didn't enforce that? He was friendly.
No, he was very friendly, yes. And in fact, they all were. Some one got on with better than others.
Was there a proper mess, a building? Or?
We tended then to have a company mess, which is usually just about 3 or 4 of us. And we got to know each other pretty well. We functioned as a battalion occasionally. And we had a battalion hockey team, for instance. And we'd play teams in Nairobi. We sometimes they even had battalion parties and so on.
What were they like?
Well, we'd make contact with the local civilians then, and it was rather fun.
Was it a traditional style mess, or was it more informal when they did have these guest nights?
Oh, very informal. Very informal, yes.
And what about the NCOs? Were they, they often used to have British NCOs and African NCOs. What was the setup in this case?
Very often you had a company sergeant major, then company quartermaster sergeant, perhaps. But they'd be part of the mess. If we're a company mess, yes.
But so they'd be allowed in your company mess, but not in the regiment if you had a battalion.
I can't remember.
And what kind of men were they? Because they could be.
Remember in Kenya, one of two oldish ones. And I think, as far as I remember, the company mess we joined in.
Were they a bit isolated? Because they weren't officers, but they weren't with the men.
There were fewer of them, but I don't know that they felt isolated. We got to know them quite well. I think we did mess together then.
What about the African NCOs? They'd be sort of the next stage down, I presume.
Yes. They were... Well, we had one or two in the 7th NRR. We had an African who was NR3, the number. He was a really old.
That was his number, 3, yes. Presumably the third to join.
Yes. I think he was the first one. He was a grand old man. They really learned an awful lot from them once. Again, they were nearly always just younger people, but they were... The old NCOs were really good chaps. And a corporal to a company, I think it was in the 7th NRR, it may have been in the later one, who had a DCM in Abyssinia. Some of them had quite a little bit.
Now, one thing we didn't mention earlier when we were talking about the language, but you didn't use pidgin English, did you? So you didn't have this sort of dialect English African. It was just African.
It was African. And I think you used pidgin in West Africa, but.
Was that a policy and the whole of the East African forces?
Yes, it was. And it was a very sound policy, too.
Why? Could you just explain that for me?
Well, I think that really, if you're talking their language, you really have to acquire their modes of thought to some extent. And apart from that, the languages are very attractive languages. They weren't too difficult to learn. And it saved an awful lot of bother. Sometimes you see I'm still sometimes in some difficulty about whether to say something is behind or in front of something. An African or Ouch and the Anglo speakers always thought of an object as looking in the same direction as one was looking oneself, so that you are in front of this table, not behind it in any sense. And lots of things like that. That's a very minor point. But with the relationships, you see, the father and the mother, you might find somebody claimed to have two or three mothers, but one would be the mother who bore him, and the other was not.
So it gave you an empathy with them. You gave them more of an idea of their culture and shared.
Indeed, yes, yes, I think so. And that was essential, really.
Did you go did you go hunting at all? Shooting? Was that a battalion thing, or was it just not done?
I don't think. I can't remember anyone doing it at all. The shooting safaris and so on were the white hunters and so on. I did meet one or two later on in the war, but I can't remember anybody going shooting.
Were you personally interested in shooting, or?
No, desperately, no. No. I got friendly with an old white hunter later on, a major in one of our battalions, and a great regard for him.
But there wasn't it. And the other thing, was there any more drinking out there? Sometimes, and what was drunk? Because there's a change in drinking in what's drunk in the mess.
I would guess. Well, quite a lot of local beer. See, the beer, European style beer, which was brewed in Nairobi, I think. And of course, if we ever had a family party, the Ascari drank Pombe, which was a local beer made from Munich beer, I suppose. Never smelled very nice, but they enjoyed it. Yes, I suppose we.
So you didn't switch to shorts and John Collins,
To some extent, but it really depended on what the mess had acquired.
What about the food you ate? I mean, what would you get? I mean, did you bring in African foods as well, or was it just strictly British diet?
Well, I think we had African cooks who were usually used to cooking a la European. We very much were. Yes, we get fruit and vegetable from nearby. One discovered from the pieces of grapefruit very often. The local grapefruit had tremendously thick vines, and bananas, ripe bananas, were not always yellow, they were very often green and so on. And we had an awful lot of fruit salads made from local fruit. So otherwise, Kenya, when we were there, was having a lot of bad time from almost famine among some of the parts of Kenya. And I remember seeing about 30 camels coming down from the northern frontier district, this time in Nairobi beef market. But I can't remember anything.
How did you get on with the local British or European community, civilian? I mean, and what was there? Would there be much in the theatre?
We didn't have Nairobi to make contact with actually sometimes friends or friends from back home. And otherwise, they were very, very hospitable. Very quite often with us in Nairobi, and as I say, quite being there, you'd be asked out for meals, and very much as would have happened at home, really.
Would there be this business of taking your card out to local families, or?
No.
It wasn't formalised then?
No, it wasn't. It was very much a private initiative, really.
You just made friends with local civilians as anywhere else.
Yes, but again, I remember on my first time in Nairobi, a car stopping and asking for drinks at the Nairobi club, and the chap in business said, yes, of course, I'm very interested in what's going on in North Africa. My young brother's just been given command there. It turned out that this man's name was Montgomery.
Would the European community, was it British, or would there be other nationalities?
Almost entirely British, I think, or the ones whom I met. But well, curious enough, one of the people I knew from home was called and someone, a family from here who were originally, I think, from South Africa, but who were, they lived in Edinburgh, and they contacted us. One of the daughters whom I knew who had married in Nairobi, and she invited us out to a new one. So she doesn't sound British, but she was.
There anything else before you were sent on a battle course, weren't you? A battle drill course at I can't quite read my notes there. That was in December 1942. What do you remember of this battle drill course, and who was taking it? Because it and this was at Nakoru, N-A-K-O-R.
You are you. Yes. And when it was very much, I think all my, we were all subalterns or captains. Maybe not, I think all subalterns. And we had a pretty strenuous time.
What sort of thing was it? Just what you mentioned before, just the same thing?
Pretty much, but then very much more on the ground and doing things like assault courses over rivers frequented by hippos and things like that. And very unfortunately, I remember there arriving with a friend who had saying I was through the river or cross it by a rope, and we arrived, and there was a time element in it. So I said, after you, Claude. He went ahead and unfortunately stood in a grenade, which was there, and blew his foot off and was killed. And he died very shortly afterwards. So the one very sad recollection of the was carrying his coffin in a very nice job. Otherwise, I spent a day, I remember, carrying a 2-inch mortar on a 4-day scheme. But then, rather ingeniously, I noticed that there was a truck thereby with a driver and nobody with it belonging to the battle school. So I suggested that we got on this and came back and was had up by the colonel he was suggesting that I should go back and finish the hike as I should have done. I said that initiative tests were always part of that original course. He said, we do this as the initiative test. Oh, never thought of that. All right.
Who was running the battle school, the Nakoru?
It was very much the people who did detail, I suppose.
It was an actual battle school?
Yes. It was commanded, I think, by a colonel or the directing staff or the senior leaders, captains.
And then you went back to your unit, I presume? And were you trying to, I mean, you'd done it to your platoon a bit. Were you now, after you'd been on the course, trying to bring it into the rest of the battalion, or?
Well, I was qualified, I think, to do so. But again, you see, we were scattered out guarding a couple of POWs, and there was very little training that one could effectively do. I had one or two spells on the attachment guarding. Having RAF supplies and so on, but it was very much rather dull jobs in the whole.